I'm Nicholas Barrett.
I'm Nicholas Poitier.
I'm Akfira Aliyah.
And I'm Katya Knežević.
And you're listening to The Sound of Economics. Now, we like to think that we're all living in a meritocracy, striving towards our ambitions in a fair and equal workplace. And by we, I mean men, because it's a different story for women. And Nicholas is here because this was a key part of his PhD thesis, which is called...
Essays on Education, Fertility and the Welfare State.
So why don't you tell us what you've been working on?
So the start of this particular chapter of my thesis was actually from a demographics perspective. So I looked at the demographical change in the birth rate, and it's very apparent that to understand demographical change and there's not a single European country that has birth rates above replacement rate. So all populations in Europe are aging with all kinds of problems for pensions. You have to understand the choices that women have to make between the trade-offs that they face between having children and not having children. So I base my paper, or part of my paper, the empirical part, on the work of Henrik Kleven, Camille Landais, and Jakob Eckert-Sørgaard, I hope I didn't butcher any name there, who kind of estimate the what's called the child penalty. It is how much, basically, the effect of having the first child has on your labor earnings. And it turns out that it's about, it varies by country, but they used to do it for Denmark, and it has like 20%, the labor income decreases by 20%. It's persistent over 20 years. I do the same exercise for Germany. I find something around 40%. It's also persistent over 15 years. And this can actually explain, for Denmark, up to 80% of differences in earnings. Not the gender pay gap, that's something different, but lifetime earnings difference. So this is something, a result of child, of the effects of childbirth.
And so wait, what's that 80% number?
So if you compare the lifetime income of a woman to a lifetime income of a man...
In Denmark,
a lifetime income of a woman tends to be 25% lower than that of men. And of this 24%, nowadays, 80% is explained by childbirth. This is very different from other countries. So Denmark, Scandinavia, is known to be a rather equal society. So for a country like Germany, it probably would look different.
So Katya was joining us today, and Katya is involved in the Brussels Binder project. Do you want to tell us what that is?
Yes, of course. Thank you, Nicholas. So the Brussels Binder is an online platform started some 3 to 4 years ago by a group of women from Brussels think tanks. It's basically an online database of female experts. It was primarily designed to basically provide journalists and events organizers with a source of a source where they can find female experts in different fields, because we have all across think tanks noticed a conspicuous lack of women in policy discussions, in articles, in the news, everywhere. And women do make up half of the population, and they do have the necessary talent, expertise and skills. And we found it that it's crucial that women get to participate in the policy-making discussions and decisions, but they seem to be often overlooked. I've been working with the Binder for now, as I said, almost 3 years, and learning from the stories of the other women and having discussions with them, it's really hard to pinpoint one particular reason as to why female experts tend to be overlooked. So it's a conundrum of basically different factors that I've come to learn start from very early in life, which then snowball into a wide kind of inequality between men and women.
So, Matfir, you are our human resources representative at Bruegel. You're head of human resources here. The majority of the economists here are men. The majority of listeners to this podcast are men. It's not just us. I used to work for The Economist magazine. The vast proportion of our subscribers were men. And, of course, there could be a kind of self-reinforcing cycle here where young women see economists dominated by men and then feel like it's a man's game, or it's a man's profession, or just a man's arena. Why do you think this is going to change in the years ahead? And what can think tanks, universities, perhaps central banks do to equalize the playing field?
Yeah, that's so true. I mean,
economics world seems to be very much dominated by men. And we see it even amongst our pool of fellows. We have more men than women being part of that pool, which is something we've been trying to address for many years. And hence also we are hosting the Brussels Binder here because we are very much wary of the issues related to that. And yes, it is actually beyond institution itself. It's so important to have more women participating in the policy making, economics policy making, because it affects us even more than men as a woman. What Nicolas was saying just earlier about the findings of his study, they speak to me so much at personal as well as professional level, because I have two children, and both times I had a child, I had to stop working like for a year or two, and picking up my new job, it was more difficult to go back to the job market. It was more difficult to balance private and professional life, because I had to make a compromise. I had to pick up a part-time job, which automatically meant that I could not look for a career development, because typically you have to be full-time at work if you want to grow and develop and take more responsibilities. So what we can do as a think tank, I believe, is to develop and to research more in this area. How can we create conditions for more women to participate more? At our level, also at the political level, it's still quite appalling to see how few women participate in our political life. So we have gender imbalance in all levels. And then we have a gender pay gap, which is crucial, I mean, for empowering women to be more. And even negotiating their role is so important. For example, giving up a job for a woman to stay with a child is much more automatic than asking the partner, the male partner in this case, to stop work because he's the breadwinner. He wins more than a woman. And if you stop working as a woman, the impact is much lesser than if your husband stops working. So it does really speak to me in many levels.
So, Nicolas, I mean, Europe seems to be quite proud of itself in comparison to, say, American politics, for instance, in the fact that we have what are considered fairly progressive laws related to maternity leave and paternity leave and so on. But part of what you've talked about is that in the years where people typically have children, those are also the years where your earnings grow at the highest speed. So you've said that they may potentially be the most important years for somebody's career. Firstly, why is that? And secondly, do you believe this is a factor in the fact that Europe has this aging population?
So, there's like two questions. Maybe the easier question first, the aging of the population. So the aging of the population that we see now is a result of the birth rates that we've seen in like 20, 30, 40 years ago until today. And they were certainly affected, and this is kind of what the core of the paper is about. Is basically an effect of mostly more and more women deciding not to have children. So it used to be that the birth rate decreases because women have less children. Now it is basically because more children decide to stay childless. And this is definitely to do with the labor market opportunities that, I mean, many, many things have changed. So as an economist, I look at the economic side of this. There's many societal changes as well. But from the economic side, now there's so many more opportunities to work for women. Women are better educated, have more opportunities on the labor market than they ever had, despite all the challenges that we have. And I don't want to lessen that. And this has, of course, affected the birth rates. But I would caution against seeing the birth rates through this angle. I think this is why it is the case, but I don't think birth rates should be a policy outcome. I mean, they are what they are. And I think more important is that we make the most of, that we kind of make the best opportunities for the people of now. I'm very skeptical of the, even if one would want to change birth rates, that policy could actually do that to a substantial way. So the second part of your question, which is why is this the most important years of your career? And talking from my field in academia and in kind of this academic environment at Bruegel, You have very long years of education. So someone that starts, that you have to study, you have to do a PhD, and then you start working. And most people on the end of the 20s, beginning of the 30s. And then actually in this period afterwards, you have to publish a lot to get a fixed position at a university, at a think tank or something like this. And if you drop out then out of the labor force to take care of children for 1 or 2 years, you will lose these years to build up a CV, to build up a reputation, that men don't have this problem. And we can see this in this estimation, in this looking at the effect of children on labor market outcomes, that all is affect. It's almost exclusively affecting women. Men do, even in countries where there's paternal leave, for men and women, it's mostly the women that take this up, and men don't really participate much.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I just had a friend who finished his PhD in November 2019, and I saw him tweet that he had spent, that December of 2019 was the only month of that decade where he hadn't been a student, where he hadn't basically been in full-time education. And he's my age, basically. I'm 29, I think he's 28. So you're coming up to the age where you might be typically thinking about starting a family. So he spent all that time just working on his education. Mm-hmm. So he's now got a PhD. If he was thinking about starting a family, he would have to presumably wait. And he, you know, because he's been a student, he's never really had a disposable income. He'd have to wait 5 years. I mean, well, not wait 5 years, but he might have to slow down his career. If he was a woman, she would have to slow down her career for those years coming out of that. So I think that's maybe it's a bigger problem in academia than it is anywhere else. But then, of course, you get a kind of slanted academia where men are having all the ideas and publishing all the articles and giving all the lectures.
Mm. Yes, indeed.
Well, if I may chip in, not directly related to gender, but maybe just to what societal changes we have experienced since the crisis of 2008 and 2009, is that the market dynamics have changed significantly. I'm sure all of us know at least a handful of people who have had to go through a number of unpaid or very low paid internships before landing their first job, even if they weren't in the field of academia, but just completed a master and wanted to get out there. So I would assume that too impacts both genders. In terms of when they make the next decisions in their lives, in terms of family.
So perhaps this is a question for everybody, but have there been any kind of successful initiatives to get over this that anyone knows of?
I think the world is changing, though. I mean, we see a lot of progress at every level, so organizations are becoming more mindful of that. And also at Bruegel, for example, we are trying to provide more facilities in order to accommodate the needs of women, such as, you know, teleworking. But still, so yes, the answer would be to that from my point of view. Yes, things are gradually changing. And in some European states, even parental leave is becoming compulsory for men as for women, which puts them both in the same levels of starting off. So that's also a progress. However, there is still a lot to do. Last week, I went to see an exhibition on feminists in the 70s in Belgium, and I was shocked to see all these slogans that the women were bearing at that time, and you would think they were from last year's march on the 8th of March. So there is still gender pay gap, there is still inequality, whether sometimes can be also perceived, but what we see is that there is a lot more to be done. And I think from the woman's perspective, what we can do is to continue raise awareness and empower each other. And obviously, for example, in situations of interview, I face every time a huge difference between men and women, how they approach a job or how they value themselves.
That's interesting, because you sit in on all the interviews. So what have you noticed?
Well, what I notice is that women underplay their own value a lot of times. The way men sell their own skills is incredibly, they are much better than us in saying how good they are in certain things. And we play it down as if we were, you know, waiting for others to affirm it or to say you're great. So we should know our value and we should put it forwards. And also in terms of negotiating salaries, I see in most of cases, women ask less than men. So their negotiation skills are different. But also that has to do perhaps also with the perception of how they value the incentives. And that should not be somehow abused in a way by organizations, because I think men can be more tempted to say, well, that's a value I have and that's a price you have to give to itself. Whereas women are perhaps more relating themselves to certain motivation of doing well their jobs and getting the reward in a different way, like being told that you're great, perhaps might have more weight than just the salary. So,
if I could follow up on that, well, I personally, and in a biased way, consider the Brussels Binder a case study for a successful initiative of recent years, and that has thankfully been growing more and more. But what I've noticed, both working at the initiative and just simply from personal experience, I think that any policy discussions or potential decisions that can be made are significantly lacking data. I think there's basically that everybody should kind of dig deeper, and self-reported data can be very unreliable. To be more specific, the gender pay gap and the reason why childcare seems to affect women more is because there is this unspoken, assumed idea that the woman will take over everything herself. And unfortunately, it's not just an expectation that society imposes on her, it's something that she imposes on herself as well. Women are still likely to aim for the idea of having it all and doing it all than, you know, trying to persuade the system to change. And this is something that I've learned to call unconscious bias that prevails equally in both men and women, and what they perceive what their gender should do and what the opposite gender should do. And whilst preparing for a presentation at a different event for the Brussels Binder, I've stumbled upon a study that says that kind of that disparity of view starts actually very early, already at the age of 6. Girls tend to perceive boys as being smarter than them inexplicably. So obviously this is something very intangible and not something that people are likely to be even aware of themselves. I doubt any kindergarten teacher or any parent of a small child will say confidently, oh yeah, definitely, my son is smarter than my daughter. But somehow through wrongly inherited values, or rather through values that are wrong and have been inherited, they've come to grow and perpetuate this kind of society.
If I can just add to that, I think the society has got a huge role to play, though, because also creating role models, let's say woman managers, for a long time we've had man managers. So a manager's role was associated to being a man. So for a woman, in order to become a good manager, had to be a bit more like a man. And this has to change. And this is changing slowly as we have more and more women in decision making, part of boards. But we still need a lot of time. And Bruegel is putting a lot of efforts there. For example, in our research team, the more junior one, we see more and more women graduated who want to do economic research, who are interested. And for me, that means that there are some women role models that are being created. And we are, as a society, we have to contribute to that. And I think, thinking about what Katya is saying, society is imposing stereotypes more than inheritance, because we as a society have created some automatisms. So boys play with trucks, boys play with things that girls don't play. So you tend to bring a girl to another playground corner than a boy, because this is how this difference is already created. But I think this is also changing slowly, though. I think we should do more on that as well.
And also, in relation to that, it's a kind of a weird snake eating its tail, kind of a vicious cycle where things that men or boys are interested in gain in value, and things that girls or women are interested in or are good at decrease in value, and it can feed into itself. I don't know if I don't know how common this knowledge is, but for example, the STEM the AI sector, the tech, the computer science was in its infancy predominantly occupied by women. The more it grew in prestige and importance, the more women got pushed out. And we are now, today in 2020, we are waking up to ridiculous slurs being thrown around by teenage boys about how girls cannot do math.
Girls do better in math than boys, though. There are statistics showing that.
And only 50 years ago, girls were basically setting the foundations of the smartphones that we are all using, you know.
Yeah.
The more prestigious a job becomes, the more likely it is that a woman will get pushed out of it.
So, Nicholas, how have our expectations for opportunities changed over the last few years?
So I think back, like if we go 2-3 generations back to our grandparents, it was a very different expectation, especially for women. So it was expected that you stay at home. It was not normal, at least at the point that when you have a child, you were supposed to take care of them. And this has changed a lot, and this had actually put a lot of pressure on men and women, on young parents, and most of this pressure is actually faced by the women. And a lot of this has actually very clear policy implications. I mean, when I was a kid, it was an innovation in Germany that children would stay until noon at school. Before, they would just send the children home. If their teacher was sick at 10, they would send the children home, and it was just expected that there would be a mother at home. We still don't really have full-day schooling. I mean, there are some kind of headline policies, full-day schooling, but it actually means someone is sent home in the afternoon. It's the availability of shopping. I mean, in a lot of small towns in Germany, shops close at 6. When both parents work, when are you supposed to buy groceries? I mean, it's very practical things that you can do a lot in terms of policies to make this easier.
Definitely, yeah. I think that workplaces can do also much more in that. More teleworking, more flexibility. Also, countries should do more in terms of providing childcare, good childcare for little ones. To go back again to my own experience, when my child was 1 year old and she started a pneumonia, and the doctor asked me, "Would you like to stay home? I think you should. Can you quit your job and be with your child?" I said, of course. I mean, I didn't think twice. I quit my job and I stayed with my child at home. And I think if there was childcare accessible, good quality, that could accommodate that need, I would have continued to work while not bringing my child to the nursery, because fundamentally it's the health of your child that is more important than anything else. So these kind of facilities, making the parental leave compulsory for men would help as well, because knowing that your partner is taking care of your child rather than some unknown person helps you think differently about your child. And you say, you know, he's in good hands of my partner. And so the decision making then becomes much easier for the woman, because that is also a moral burden, so to say, for the woman to take these decisions than just economic or career or personal.
So, Nicholas, let's just zoom out here, and I guess I'll play devil's advocate a little bit. If you're a policymaker looking at these issues, I suppose there are a few temptations. You could say, well, the thing about children is the state has to pay for their education for the first 18 years. And also, you could argue, well, children are quite bad for the environment. So is it in the government's interest to encourage people to have children when a lot of the labour gaps can be filled by migrants who can essentially be utilised and taxed as soon as they arrive? Of course, the flip side of that is that it's an emotionally very difficult, fraught argument to make in a time of polarisation and rising nationalism and jingoism. I guess what I'm asking is, How do policymakers look at this realistically, and what kind of responses have you seen so far?
So I think the first about the demographical change. I'm I think this is a tide. This is like a, I mean, there's this saying, I don't know where it originates, demography is destiny. So demography is something actually can predict decades into the future. It is something that is driven by underlying economic and societal currents. I don't think you can really effectively increase. We tried for many years now to increase the birth rates in Europe, and policymakers have tried that.
So is that to say that if we made conditions better for professional mothers, it probably wouldn't change the demographics very much?
I don't think to the point that we will not solve our pension problem by increasing birth rates. I think that's very clear to me. I don't think we should even attempt to do that. I mean, I don't think it's a goal by itself, increasing birth rates. The other thing is actually female labor force, so basically increasing the opportunity for women means, so we have this problem that more and more people are aging, are going in retirement, and therefore the number of people working is decreasing, the amount of people kind of needing pensions is increasing. So you have a problem there, like your budget, you have to expend more on pensioners and you get more money in. And one of the easy way to solve this problem is actually increasing the labor force. And you can do this, one, through immigration, and second, through basically increasing the number of people that work that you already have. And this is, for instance, female labor force. This is something, this is in some countries less, in some countries more, but it's still a huge potential that we have to increase total hours worked. I think it's also, we have, Katja was mentioning this earlier, but this kind of stereotype that girls kind of think that boys are better at school, and actually it's the opposite. Women now have better educational attainment, and we lose. If you look at the education, then we look at the labor market outcome, there's like a discrepancy. We lose a lot of women, really highly educated women and talented women in the moment in their 30s in the labor force. And I think there's a lot of potential for policymakers who don't really, even if they don't care about gender equality, which I think they should, there's a lot for them just economically to gain.
Well, I mean, for me, I think economically, if you bring society to more gender parity or equality, you solve so many questions. We don't have, as a woman, to run around and say, I want to have a choice. You cannot have a choice if you don't have enough of income. So having a good working condition and equal opportunities, man and woman, and exactly same pay, every woman who has exactly the same preparations should have exactly the same wage as men for the same amount of years of experience, that will provide us with completely another environment. Women can make a choice they want to make, if they want to move on with their career, or they want to have a different kind of life, or they want, it opens up to a completely different society. And I think this is how it has to be tackled, through equal opportunities and representation and more women speaking out there and making our policies, because we seem like opportunities are there, but they cannot be there if the basics are not there. And for me, pay gap shows it all. We cannot make choices in the same way the men do, simply.
And if I can add to that, there has already been a body of proof that companies that are gender diverse tend to perform better. Policy making also seems to be smoother or lead to fairer policies in general. Although, if I may add, I'm sure everybody wants to say it, but you know, gender equality is a sufficient enough end motivation. I shouldn't have Absolutely. To present numbers of successful companies. You know, having a balanced society or a balanced company is in itself a good thing. But also, one thing that I would like to touch upon that wasn't mentioned, and it's perhaps also often overlooked, how for men this male privilege is a sort of a golden cage, because I truly believe that as much as women fall into this trap of thinking that she has to do it all, you know, maintain a squeaky clean house and a successful career, you know, lean in and all that, I think men often themselves, and maybe you two can confirm or argue against, feel like they would maybe be, demasculated in a way if a woman were to perform more and go back to work, and a man to stay at home with a child and do the full package of childcare. So I don't know. What do you think?
No, I 100% agree with Katya. I mean, the pressure on men, the societal pressure that you have should have a career that can sustain a family by yourself. I mean, this is the expectation that you have on you, and it also constricts our choices as men. And I think we would be much freer if this expectation would be lifted from us. I think there is many, many men that would love to take care of the children and take their part of the family raising, or actually play the role that is traditionally played by women in the family, and they feel they cannot because of the societal expectations.
Thank you very much for joining us, Katya. Thank you very much, Matvija. Nicholas, it's always a pleasure. I had some very disturbing news while I was on holiday. I was sitting in a spa in Sweden and my phone rang, and I heard some of the scariest words in the English language. Hello, this is the student loan company. So I'm afraid I have to once again go back into hiding. And so my time on this podcast is coming to an end. But you can subscribe to my new podcast, The Sound of Goat Herding, on iTunes and Spotify. And it's also available on a can at the end of a string in Ulaanbaatar. So do look out for that. And thank you very much for listening. Thank you for listening to The Sound of Economics. This podcast was presented by me, Nicholas Barrett, and edited by Thiago Almeida, and brought to you by the Bruegel think tank in Brussels. To read our papers and blogs, you can visit bruegel.org, and if you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe on Spotify and iTunes, where you can also leave us a review and let other people know that we exist. And you can stay up to date with everything we do by following us on Twitter, @bruegel_org. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.